You're listening to Retronauts, a part of the Greenlit Podcast Network, a collective of creator-owned and fully independent podcasts focused on pop culture and video gaming. To learn more and to catch up on all the other network shows, check out greenlitpodcasts.com. How's everyone doing tonight? That's good. I keep waiting for, you know, to ask that question and have everyone say terrible, but...
Terrible.
Ah, there we go. So what I've been waiting for all these years. All right, well, this PAX in Retronauts, the media is the message. Thanks for joining us here at PAX East 2020. I've done enough of these that I keep forgetting what year it is. But I'm still Jeremy Parrish, as I have been all these years, and this continues to be Retronauts, but it's a different lineup this time than we've ever had before, unless you count the impromptu podcast we recorded in the hallway a few hours ago. Guys, introduce yourselves.
Hey, I am Bob, the founder of RetroRGB.com, and thank you, and also the podcast and everything else that goes with it.
I'm Benj Edwards. I am a journalist who specializes in tech history, and I just got a full-time job at How To Geek now, so I'm excited about that. I run VintageComputing.com. Thanks.
Yep. Change is in the air. And in fact, this panel topic was inspired by the fact that I've recently started working at Limited Run Games, doing media curation, and Limited Run is all about physical media of games, about preserving games on physical media so that when they are delisted from PSN or the Switch eShop, it's okay because you'll still have it and you don't have to worry about downloading it or being told, nope, sorry, you no longer own PT. If we had published PT, you would still have it, but sadly, we didn't. The phrase, the medium is the message, comes from, I think, the 1950s or 60s, a guy named Marshall McLuhan talking about the importance of television and how it shaped, like, the nature of the technology and the medium kind of shaped the way people perceive it. And kind of riffing on that, we're talking about how games media, the media on which games are published and distributed, affects the way that they are designed and the way that they work. And that's not something we face so much these days, aside from things like PT being delisted and disappearing forever from people's libraries, and Sony coming to your door and saying, you need to give us that file back. But back, you know, prior to kind of the current generation of games, I do think that physical media had a big impact on how games had to be designed and kind of limited them, but also gave them different capabilities. And we're going to talk about that. It's probably not going to be as funny as a Bob Mackey panel if you were expecting to be thoroughly entertained with amusement and hilarity. You'll have to wait for Midwest Gaming Classic for that one. Sorry about that.
Yeah, this is going to be terrible. Terrible panel.
You might not have come in saying you feel terrible tonight, but you're going to leave saying that. That's our guarantee.
You're going to be like, I got my money's worth, yeah.
But no, this is more of a historic overview, more of a, I think, a somewhat serious discussion about, you know, how video games have been shaped through the years, and that's why I called in these guys. They're kind of the ringers. They know a lot about tech. They know a lot about, tech. Basically.
I knew
Do you know other stuff?
I knew a lot about tech, but I forgot all of it right before I came in the room.
Well, I really hope it floods back to your brain as you read these notes that I put together.
So,
I'm going to start by asking you guys here on the panel, what was the first kind of video game that you remember playing? Like, what medium was it stored on? Was it a cartridge, a diskette? Was it an arcade board?
It was a 5 1/4 inch floppy drive on a Tandy 1000. And I think it was Zaxxon was the first one that I remember. Zaxxon or King's Quest, I can't remember which game.
That's cool. Yeah, one of my first games I remember playing was Donkey Kong on the Atari 800, which came on a little brown cartridge. And basketball as well. My brother used to frustrate me. I have a brother who's 5 years older than me, and I was like really little, and so he'd just keep the ball away, and it was really frustrating. But he thought it was hilarious. Anyway, yeah, cartridges.
Yeah, okay. And my first video game memory is playing Ms. Pac-Man in the arcades, So each of these were very different experiences, and I think each of the games came out differently. Bob, you mentioned a crossover there, Zaxxon on Tandy. Mm-hmm. I feel like the Tandy version was not authentic to the arcade in most respects.
No. It was more like a worse version of the Master System version of Zaxxon.
Okay, which was like a better version of the ColecoVision version.
Yeah.
So somewhere in between.
Was it CGA graphics?
Yes.
For that? Yeah. That was a rough period.
But I will say, we'll get to cartridges later, because we're taking a chronological journey, and cartridges came in after video games had been around for a while. To begin with, we actually want to go all the way back to the beginning, when video games came on paper cards that you punched holes in, punch cards. We were talking before this panel to figure out if we have ever actually used punch cards ourselves, and I don't know that we have, aside from like SAT tests, which isn't really video games.
Yeah. No. That predates us. My dad used them in college, that kind of thing, you know. And I still know, up until the 80s, they still had mainframes in colleges where they had to do batch processing on cards and stick them in a thing, and they run them through and load the program, and you get the results a day later printed out for you.
Has anyone out here actually done programming on punch cards? One, all right.
Cool.
How was that experience for you?
It sucked.
Yeah.
Which is about what I would expect. So basically, yeah, punch card, that's the data right there, the ROMs, the ones and zeros, basically. Like, there's a hole there, so that means what, on, basically? Like, that's the bit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Each column is a byte.
Oh, yeah, it's got, yeah, that's a whole byte there.
Yeah, and there's 80 columns. That's where we got the 80-column screen from, ironically enough, from the 80-column punch card.
So there's not really a lot you can do with a game made on a punch card like this. But in the very early days of video games, computers weren't something you had in your home. They were something you went to a university or to a science lab and snuck in past the military guards to get to. And you couldn't take the video game home with you. You put it on a storage media such as this or a reel-to-reel tape. I found a really great photo of an authentic 1970s computing experience right there. You put it on these kind of shared storage spaces, and everyone could kind of jump in and access the files or modify them. And so there was this real kind of collaborative sense in the early days of games like, is it Space War or Computer Space? I always get those two mixed up.
Space War,
right?
Yeah,
okay. And Zork and so forth, where lots of people collaborated on someone else's original idea, and it just got better and better as it kind of circulated, and more people threw in ideas and improvements to the code and so forth. But again, you know, a punch card, there's not much there. So these games tended to be very small, and they took a long time to load. And Nintendo brought this technology back in the early 2000s with the e-reader for Game Boy Advance, so you too could play Donkey Kong Jr. by sliding a paper card through a scanner 10 times.
Progress.
I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Something like that.
And the Barcode Battler, remember that?
I do remember Barcode Battler.
Cool.
But eventually, we moved on to the days of the arcade, and people started creating custom boards for arcade games, and you could do more with this. Look at all those chips on there. Those chips have got to hold way more than one or two bits or bytes, like the punch card did.
These were
kind of present and sort of the mainstay of arcades for a very long time. People would build brand new boards essentially for each game they wanted to create, until some of the standards kind of came along a little bit later, in the 80s. But basically they use, it says TTL logic chips. What is TTL logic?
I wrote that. Transistor logic. I don't know what it means.
Okay, great. There's a
series of chips made by TI and the logic chips that were just, a combination of gates into an integrated circuit. And then the whole history of electronics and all technology is combining things into another modules you could stick into other things, and combining all that into a small package. And then, so at this phase in technology, they weren't doing discrete components as much. They had ICs that combined a lot of functionality, but they weren't using microprocessors yet. So, yeah.
But lots of important games came from these discrete logic boards.
Yeah, like
such as
Pong,
yes.
Computer Space,
Space Race.
Yeah, didn't I
write X-City's Death Race?
Yeah,
why did you have that one?
That's a great game, Death Race. Run
okay,
people down.
It's kind of very specific, though.
Yeah.
Space Invaders, that's another one.
No, Space Invaders used an 8080
Oh,
CPU.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
A computer?
Yeah.
Yeah, Heianko Alien actually began as an arcade, as a computer game. Yeah. So that was probably on a diskette. I haven't actually looked into that one. I kind of let you down, sorry.
So the weird thing about this, the discrete logic games, is that they were not programmed, so to speak, with software. They had to list out the program in logic and how it would manipulate the spots on the screen and everything. And I asked Al Alcorn one time, how did you just wrap your head around it? And he just said, I just did it. It wasn't a great answer. Because I was so used to, we think about sitting down at a keyboard and programming a piece of software and running it on a computer, but they had to wrap their head around doing it physically, manipulating the video signal at a raw level. Anyway, incredible.
But eventually people wanted to bring video games home and make money that way, because you can only make so much in the arcades. You can make basically nothing at universities and military laboratories. So home was where the money was. And these discrete logic chips, which required basically custom design every time and were kind of relatively expensive to manufacture versus something that was more standardized, wouldn't cut it. Yes, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
So we start seeing a transition into home consoles in the early 70s, the first being the Magnavox Odyssey 2, which... Magnavox Odyssey 1. Yes, I guess that came first.
Yeah.
thank you, Benj.
It's not like the Xbox, where they make the
right.
Xbox
yeah,
music
see,
and then the Xbox One.
Microsoft makes it really confusing.
Xbox is backwards. Anyway, yeah.
So the Odyssey 1 actually had all of its games built into the system, but it did use something kind of like cartridges or cards, as you see on the right side there. All these things came with the Odyssey 1, plus it came with screen overlays that you stuck on your television screen to pretend you were playing like hockey or something, even though it was just the same little dots moving around. But those cards on the right side, those were jumpers that you would insert into the console, and it would basically change the arrangement of the circuits inside and cause it to activate a different built-in game. So the games were there. You just had to manually, physically switch the computer around to bring those to life. So that's pretty limiting, I would say. You were kind of limited to what was built into the console.
Yeah, there's the Odyssey 1 had a whole bunch of modules, like a spot generator modules and a line generator module and different sort of logic. You turn on and off whether the balls will collide with each other and disappear. And that's what those cards are doing. They are jumpering those things on and off. And if you think about it, I don't know how many bits of storage that is. There's 28 pins on each side of one of those cards. Somebody could do the math, but that's a certain 256 bits of storage. Technically,
sounds good to me.
Programming the console.
This isn't tax season, so you can just make up numbers.
Even though it's not, I just made that up. But even though it's not a software-based computer inside, it was telling the program what to do. I mean, the console what to display, and they made up for the limitations of the games with, I think they had three spots. Two player-controlled spots and a ball and a net. And so you could move the spots around, turn them on and off, so they had the overlays, and then they added in this board game paraphernalia, which is these, you could do a roulette game where you paste the cellophane thing on the screen with a roulette wheel, and one person has to close their eyes. In the instructions, it says, close your eyes and fiddle with the knobs and see where it ends up, so you can gamble with your friends doing that.
Anyway. Yeah, there's a lot of kind of trusting your friends to play correctly when it came to the Odyssey.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, see, I knew Ralph Baer, who created this, and I played it with him in his basement in 2012. It was one of his prototypes, and I think he let me win because he was really good at it. But there's also there was an English knob. It's not like Pong had this incident reflection circuit where it would actually bounce off the paddle at the angle it hits it, but the Odyssey had no such thing. You had to actually move an English knob to surprise people. So at the last minute, as the ball's going by, you can go whoop and go around the guy's thing.
But the important thing is, for for the purposes of this conversation, those were all built into the console when it shipped.
Yeah.
So that wasn't something you could add to the console.
You could interpret the spots in a different way, I'd say. They did add on extra kits and stuff you could buy, but they had extra overlays and little parts. Yes, very limited.
But consoles would expand considerably 3 years later when a company called Fairchild Electronics, or Fairchild something or another, came out with the Channel F.
Yeah.
And that was the first console to have cartridges. And I was going to ask, like, hey, what's everyone's favorite form of physical media for video games? But everyone's answer should be cartridges, because they are the best. They are versatile and amazing, and they have limitations, yes, absolutely. They tend to be more expensive than optical media or magnetic media. They tend to be lower in capacity for the price. But they're so good in so many other ways. They're so durable. You know, a Nintendo cartridge or an Atari cartridge, you can plug it in if it's the contacts are clean. It's probably still going to work, where you can't necessarily say that with a 30 or 40 or 50-year-old diskette. You can do so much to add on to cartridges, and we're going to look at the way that actually happened. But the important thing about cartridges when it came to console design is that the console didn't have to have games built into it. It could just be a device that ran programs, and the program code was in the cartridge. So anytime you put a different cartridge in, you would be running a different program, creating a different game, or playing a different game, and it was really only limited by the technical capacity of the console. Yeah. And the storage capacity of the cartridge, I guess.
Yeah, games as software was a revolutionary idea, although it was inevitable. But I did a huge article for Fast Company about the origins of the video game cartridge back in like 2014 or 15. If you want to look that up, I found the people who invented the cartridge idea, Wallace Kirshner and Haskell. I forgot his name. And they worked for a company called Alpex that had done some adding machine equipment, and they invented this idea in the early 70s, about 73, of doing a pluggable cartridge to change software out with an 8080 chip, and they got Fairchild's attention, and Fairchild licensed it, and then the rest is history. So, and Fairchild is everybody loves the Jerry Lawson story, one of the black pioneers. So it's the last day of Black History Month, so.
Right.
Yep.
So talking about the things that cartridges can do that you can add to the cartridges, here's one of the most famous examples of a cartridge that does way more than, or lets the console do way more than it's supposed to do. And this is Akumajo Densetsu, or Castlevania 3. The Japanese version ran on a special chip. It was a series of chips that Konami created that they could only use in Japan, because Nintendo of America was like, actually, we want to control everything. And so you can only use certain chips that we create and we provide. But in Japan, they were a little more free to do stuff. So everyone remembers the adventures of Luke Wilson as he fought Dracula. He's not the only Wilson that likes games, but his brother's more into, wow. Yeah, thanks, I workshopped that one for a while. This game, not only could it do way more than the Nintendo or the Famicom could do by default, which was basically Super Mario Brothers. Super Mario Brothers was the NES hardware at its fundamental level, firing on all cylinders, doing as much as the console inherently could. These chips had additional processors inside of them. They could do add extra memory, extra storage. In the case of this particular cartridge, it had the ability to play extra sound channels, so the music was much richer. There was better animation in the backgrounds of the screens, of the stages, and there were more animations for characters and so forth. It was really, like, if you played this immediately after playing, you know, the early Nintendo games, you'd be like, is this really the same console? But it was. And Konami, that wasn't the most advanced chip they made. The most advanced chip they made was actually the VRC7, which was in this game, Lagrange Point. And this basically, you notice that this cartridge is way taller than Akumajo Densetsu. That's because the VRC6 is a huge chip. It's like the size of an NES cartridge, basically. And, you know, Famicom carts were half the size of an NES cart. But the reason it's so big is because it had a separate sound processor inside of it. It had basically the equivalent of the FM synthesis add-on that Sega created for the Master System in Japan, which was a module that plugged into the system. But you didn't have to have a module to hear the amazing, like, arcade quality sound in this game. It was built into the cartridge. It was also really, really expensive, but when you plug this into your system and you hear the music coming out, you're like, how is my Nintendo doing this? And that's because a cartridge is able to do that. You can put that stuff inside. Do you guys have any NES or Famicom or other carts that you're especially like, I can't believe that happened?
Super Mario 3, probably, for me. Just seeing the difference in graphics between number 1 and number 3 was pretty mind-blowing as a kid. It's still pretty fascinating now that I actually understand why it's so much better, but just nothing would ever compare to the fact of plugging both games in and just going, I can't believe this is the same console. So.
Yeah, Castlevania 3 is amazing, which you were just talking about. But also, I was sharing with Jeremy, I did a piece a long time ago about weird internal cartridge expansion chips and stuff. And the weirdest one that I ever saw was for the Odyssey 2. That was actually the Philips VideoPak G700, whatever it was in Europe. That console is so primitive that when they wanted to make a chess game, they just made a cartridge and put a little wire out to it and a huge extra computer that you put on the top of the thing to give it more horsepower to play a game of chess. So, and it's all coming through the cartridge port.
Yeah, I feel like adding another computer to your console is probably taking things a little too far.
It's 32X.
But that's taking two things too far. Yeah. That same trick was used for Go games in Japan, which is basically Japanese chess, approximately. There were some Super NES Super Famicom games that actually had ARM chips inside of them, like the same processor or more powerful than what ran the Game Boy Advance, was showing up inside of cartridges in Japan only, because Nintendo of America was like, that's ridiculous, let's not do that. But you know, these cartridges sold for like $150 a piece. They were really expensive. Yeah. But if you wanted a very detailed, accurate simulation of the board game Go that could challenge you like no other, then you wanted one of these games from, I think, SETA that had its own basically computer inside of it.
Yeah, are you going to do the FX chip?
I think first we should look at this little guy, the Aladdin Deck Enhancer. This is like the exhibit of video game cartridges. I heard you like a video game, so we put a cartridge inside your cartridge.
Yeah.
So you plug the Deck Enhancer into your NES, and then you could plug these little mini cartridges into that. I'm not really sure what the advantage there was. Was it to work around the lockout system?
Yeah, I think so. So they didn't have to duplicate the lockout chip every time, and it could be lower cost. But I got an Aladdin that was new in the box on eBay like 20 years ago, and it never got to work. I think it was just junk, like new old stock that never worked. So I don't even know if they actually worked at all. Has anybody gotten an Aladdin to work before? Yeah, okay.
Did it work? No?
It worked, yeah. Yeah. Yep. So it's a smaller... It's just dumb. It's more plastic. I don't know. There was a lot of empty space in NES cartridges. In fact, I have a small story about that. The NES game 720, my brother had it when I was a kid, and he put it on the back of my dad's car, and then later, like, where's the game? And we're like, oh, crap. He drove off with the cartridge on the top of the car. So we went around the neighborhood and looked for it, and we got it, and it was all crushed. And we put it in, and it still worked. But so then we took it apart, and like the bottom third of the cartridge has a PC board in it. So the top part that got crushed, luckily they got run over, was fine. So we still have that. I still have that crushed cartridge, and I play it every once in a while. There you go.
So next up is kind of a more enjoyable version of the Aladdin Deck Enhancer, and that's the Super Game Boy, which was basically a cartridge that had a Game Boy inside of it that then could output video to the Super NES. And so then you'd plug in a Game Boy cartridge and you could play Game Boy games. But not only that, you could play Game Boy games with enhancements. You could change the color palette. Some games had borders and special color palettes programmed into them. The one that I showed here is actually the fanciest of all the Game Boy, Super Game Boy games, Space Invaders. You might think a 1978?
Yeah,
77, 79?
Nine.
We're making up numbers again.
78 and a half.
So this. Yeah. Anyway, you're probably not getting hung up on the numbers, but you're probably thinking to yourself, how could this game from the 1970s have been the pinnacle of a device released in 1993? And that is because Taito, in all their insanity, put a Super NES game inside of the Game Boy cartridge. So when you play it in the Super Game Boy, you can choose to boot into the Super NES mode, and it just resets your system, basically, and relaunches, and you play a Super NES version of Space Invaders that is not accessible by playing it on your Game Boy, obviously. Like, the Game Boy game is also still in there, but it was just a thing they could do. And they took advantage of this this really esoteric feature, and no one else did, which makes this very unique kind of Game Boy game. So if you ever have the chance to buy the American Space Invaders for Game Boy, do it, because you're getting two games in one.
Yeah, my favorite Super Game Boy game that does something weird is Street Fighter 2, because you can actually use a second controller port to play two-player head-on-head, one-on-one, head-to-head in that game. Anyway. Bob?
I think we're about to just send a bunch of people out to scour Space Invaders now. So
I mean, it's going to go for cheap. It's like $5. So yeah. That's two games for the price of like half a game.
Yeah.
It's very inexpensive. Bob, do you have any favorite Super Game Boy enhancements? Any
Zelda, the Link's Awakening. I think if you put the DX version in, it changes. It has the different palettes on the outside. My cousin always loved Donkey Kong. He loved the different thing on that, too. But my favorite Game Boy game is always going to be Metroid 2. So.
Yeah. But that was before the Super Game Boy, so
True.
We missed out on the DX.
But they put
kept
it on the box.
They did. They did. It was a lie. Well, I guess it made the game a little more, like you could see Samus a little more easily. I don't know.
Yeah, you could see everything a lot more easily.
That's
I mean,
true.
The Game Boy screen was pretty terrible. The
That's
first
true.
One.
This was before Game Boy Pocket.
Yeah.
True.
Also, you have another Game Boy gadget here, another personal favorite. Sorry, I only had a photograph of Blue on Blue, so it's a little hard
back.
To see, but
yeah.
That is the Game Boy camera, which, as the name implies, is a digital camera built into a game cartridge. Try doing that with your CD-ROM, I ask you. It's not going to happen.
Yeah. It'd be spinning around real fast, that camera. It'd be the weirdest thing.
Another great one, WarioWare Twisted. This has an accelerometer inside of it. Basically, there were a few other games that did this, but I think WarioWare Twisted did it best. Basically, all the games, the mini games, micro games, I guess technically, in this game, controlled by tilting the system. And it could register all those different degrees of motion. And they just built that right into the cartridge and made for a really unique video game, like really like no other. There's another one here. You can't really see the title, but this is Robopon from Atlus, which is maybe the most ridiculously overloaded Game Boy cartridge of all time. It has a real-time clock. It has a battery backup. It has an infrared port. And I want to say it has a rumble feature. There's like four or five. What's that? There's a speaker. Okay, so there's also a speaker inside the cartridge. So they basically made their own video game system for this really kind of like okay-ish Pokemon clone. It was peak Game Boy, let me tell you what.
Yeah. They must have had a lot of money to waste on that project.
Atlus? I don't know. This was before Persona hit it big, so I don't think
they had
any
money. What were they thinking? Like, yeah, this is going to be awesome. We'll put a speaker in it. Everybody's going to buy it. I don't know.
Well, they released like three or four versions of it in Japan.
Really?
Only one. I think only one of them came here.
Yeah,
but
maybe they love it. They were there.
Yeah, okay. Well, there you go.
Yeah,
it was like, you know, there was this kind of Pokemon arms race going on where everyone was like, we have the ability to use turn-based battles to catch little things and trade them. But everyone else does that, so what can we do to make it different? And some people said, let's do Hello Kitty, and some people said, let's make it Mega Man. But Atlus said, let's just give people this insane cartridge that cannot possibly be emulated. And so it's still a very valuable cartridge now because you can't emulate it.
Piracy, yeah, protection against piracy.
Okay, so apparently you could point a remote control at it, at the IR port that was built into the game cartridge. Fortunately, Nintendo's next system, the Game Boy Advance, I think had an IR port, didn't it? No? Color. Okay, that's right. And then they took it out for the Advance because Nintendo always takes out a thing that you like every time, so you'll buy the next one that'll take out a different thing.
Yeah.
And then finally, a personal favorite of mine, Boktai, The Sun Is in Your Hands. This is the game where Metal Gear creator Hideo Kojima said, you nerds need some vitamin D, go outside. He also, what's that? Yes, that's true. I did beat this game sitting by a bay window in my apartment as the sun went down across the building, behind the building across the street, and I was fighting the final battle like this. But this cartridge and the clear part at the top has an I think a UV sensor built into it that detects sunlight, or if you're very, very clever, a ultraviolet light or infrared light or whatever. You know, one of those black lights that they used to use. I did that, but it basically gave you like this real day-night cycle within the game, and you could use actual sunlight to charge up your vampire-killing gun, which was pretty clever.
Yeah. It would have been cool to do that with Castlevania 2, which has a day-night cycle.
Yeah. I feel like...
it's a terrible night to have a curse.
That would have been interesting.
In your hand.
Strangely enough, even though they're both Konami series, yeah. Boktai and Castlevania did not cross over, but Boktai did cross over with Mega Man Battle Network in Japan. So there was a vampire boss, Shade Man, that you could fight in the third game that
never
came
here.
Shade Man?
It's so easy, a Shade Man could do it.
Thank you. All right.
That's why I'm here.
And I think this is the last of the weirdo Game Boy cartridges we're going to show, but this is the one I mentioned earlier, the e-reader, where it's basically a barcode scanner that uses, like, micro dot technology, and you scan your paper card through, and then you scan another one 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 through, and then you've got pinball. And then if you want to play a different game, you do that all over again, and pinball goes away because there was only enough storage memory inside for one game at a time. But I think most people actually did not use this to play NES games. I think they mostly used it to get furniture for Animal Crossing, which was actually a very good use for it. And there were also some really, really weird levels that someone created for Super Mario Advance 4.
Yeah.
That's how they get you, Binge. Numbers are imaginary. Yeah. They mean nothing.
Nintendo's never been good at naming things, I'll just tell you that.
I don't know, that's a mouthful. It's a...
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, so this technology did not last that long, but it's interesting and kind of weird, and now we have Amiibo, which is also pretty much gone away, so time is a squared circle. Okay, so someone pointed out that, sorry, I don't know your name, but someone pointed out that Super Mario Brothers Advance, Super Mario Advance for e-reader setup can be played or emulated on Wii Virtual Console, but it's actually Wii U, so it's still available. It's like $8 or $9. So if you want to play some really strange Super Mario Brothers 3 levels, go download that to Virtual Console on the dusty Wii U that you're not using for anything else. And remember, like, oh, wow, this was a really weird system. What am I doing? But you'll also get to play some really strange levels to go with your weird system, and it all kind of fits together nicely. But I didn't want to turn this into just a Nintendo love fest. There's also Genesis and Lock-On Technology. Did you guys ever do this?
Yeah.
All right. Did you guys ever do this?
Oh, absolutely.
All right, tell us about it.
Bob, you tell.
When the short version was when they were making Sonic 3, they knew that they weren't going to have time to complete it before the holiday season, so they decided to split it up into two different games, and they had what I thought was a really neat idea of being able to lock on Sonic 3 to Sonic and Knuckles. So they're both each independent games, but when you put them together, it unlocks different things in Sonic and Knuckles and in Sonic 3, and Sega made it so that if you plug Sonic 2 into it, you could then use Sonic Knuckles in Sonic 2. And I just recently heard something about how the way they did that was by including the Sonic 2 ROM on the Sonic and Knuckles cart, so that when they plugged it in, you're not actually using the cartridge, it's just kind of authenticating it, and that's how you're able to get to different things that didn't exist before. And
so
all that.
It's just as much a lie as blast processing was.
Yeah, I mean, kinda.
I'm a little offended.
You could actually play the game, though, and that's the difference. Whereas burst mode, which doesn't really even exist that much, is, a little marketing thing.
Yeah, I always wondered how they pulled that off, putting Knuckles in Sonic 2. Yeah,
and they were going to do the same thing with Sonic 1, but they ran out of time, so then I think you just get, like, another, like, Yeah, the bonus levels, right, exactly, yeah.
Wow.
Binge, I think you wanted to mention the FX chip.
Well, what I was going to mention is, like, when we were talking about the weird chips you put in a cartridge, one of the wildest ones is the Virtua Racing for the Genesis that has the SVP chip, and that cartridge costs, it's like a special DSP chip that runs at 23 megahertz. It's like a super high-speed chip for that. But
yeah, the Genesis is like 7 megahertz. So it's about
68,000, and it's yeah.
It's about three times as fast in terms of just pure megahertz as the Genesis itself.
It's a good version of Virtua Fighter, although it's kind of Virtua Racing, but it's kind of low resolution. But it just made the cartridge cost $100 a piece, which is crazy, and they never did that again. But that's the weirdest, like most powerful chip I've ever seen. I think it may have been more beefy than the FX2 or something. I don't know.
Maybe I still think the Shogi and Go chips in Japan only were. Probably more powerful, but they're like at a certain point, you're just like, why not just buy a computer?
Yeah, well, you can't put a computer in your pocket, right?
It depends on the computer.
Well, you can now.
Exactly. See, technology caught up
back
with us.
Back then, you couldn't.
But yeah, I think that's about it for the days of cartridges and the cool things they can do. We still have cartridges these days, but Nintendo doesn't put weird stuff into their Switch chips anymore. I guess because it has the little hatch that you close over the top of it. Basically, ever since the 3DS, I want to say, they started putting a little clasp over their cartridges so you don't lose them, which I guess is good. But it does, you know, it does prevent like these big weird things dangling out. I kind of miss the days of, using a DS Lite and having some big weird bulging thing sticking out from the Game Boy Advance slot. Those were
good
times.
Not safe for work.
What's that?
Not safe for work.
It was perfectly safe for work. I worked at a video games website, so it was fine.
Okay.
There were cool things like the Arkanoid DS paddle, where it was Game Boy cartridge that was actually just a DS paddle, like a paddle controller for your DS, and you could play a great game of Arkanoid on your DS.
Wasn't there a RAM cartridge for the DS that you could put in to play? It was just for the browser? Okay, for the web browser.
And there was also... Play-On for Game Boy Advance, which turned your Game Boy Advance into a multimedia player.
They should be doing this presentation. They know more than
that. I know, right?
It's great.
Should get mics out there. Yeah. Anyway, I'm lingering on cartridges, but it's just because they're so cool, because now we're on to the next stage of history, which is diskettes. And all right, we've got some diskette fans out there, so what's up with that? I mean, I ask this in all seriousness. They always seem like a very fragile and difficult sort of media. Like, you can't touch it in the wrong place or your game will disappear. And also, don't leave it in sunlight, and also don't put it any place close to a magnetic field. You know, like all the magnets that are in your speakers and your computer and so forth. Keep it away from your computer when you're using it in your computer. It's just very limiting. But I guess at the time, they were kind of good, especially compared to cartridges.
Well, for the density of what you could store on them versus the cost, they were incredible. You know, they're very cheap for the amount of storage you could fit in small space.
And they were rewritable. That's a hard word to say when you're in a panel. They were rewritable, so you could save data. You could, save your state in a game. You could save custom load runner levels. You could program your own games and save it and send it to your friends. You could copy someone else's game that they paid money for and share that with all your friends and make your favorite developers go out of business. It was a really versatile sort of media.
That's what I did. I mean, that's what it was all about. Retro gaming is about putting people out of business.
Is that true, Bob?
No.
Okay. So we have a difference of opinion up here. Yeah. So there are a lot of good things to diskettes, and they did become smaller physically over time, but gradually higher in capacity. And, you know, by the time Sony invented the 3.5-inch diskette, you had that little shutter slide window there, so it was you actually had to try to erase those disks. You had to actually, like, pull the little slide aside and say, and at that point, like, you know
like
what you're doing.
Hulk.
That's like hitting a cartridge with a hammer. Just don't do that.
Yeah.
A few consoles did see diskette add-ons. Most notably, Nintendo in Japan released the Famicom Disk System, an add-on for their equivalent of the NES, which actually expanded the capabilities of the console, not with the disk itself, but it did add another sound channel. But the disks were higher capacity than could be like the equivalent of cartridges when this was released. So this is where you got games like The Legend of Zelda and Metroid and Kid Icarus. They appeared first on diskette, and then we had to wait in America until cartridges kind of caught up with the diskettes to get big enough.
You could save your progress on the disc too, which is
save
cool.
your progress. Yeah. We had to get batteries in our cartridges for that. Mm-hmm. And also there was the disc kiosks where you could take one of the blue discs and take it to a convenience store, pay just a few dollars for the disc, plug it in, and for a few dollars download a game to it. And then when you were sick of that game, because it was like a square game by disc operating group, which was terrible, you could go back and you could replace it with something you liked, like Golf Here or Exciting Basket, which is Double Dribble, or Clue Clue Land. I don't know.
Why would you want to do that?
Clue Clue Land is great. Yeah. It's Nintendo's first female protagonist. Yeah. Don't forget it. But yeah, like the diskettes for Famicom Disk System were also vulnerable. The standard storage diskettes did not have any kind of window to protect the media. The rewritable ones did, and they came with little signs, as you can see, embedded into them that said, Don't touch. Yeah. So they kind of learned that, hey, maybe kids aren't very smart when it comes to diskettes.
Whoa,
what is this thing? Oh, right, this is Deco. We're moving along to tape cassettes. Tape cassettes were like the worst version of diskettes. The good thing about tape cassettes is that you could go to the store and you could buy a tape cassette. And then you could use that tape cassette, and instead of putting music on it, you could put game data on it or program data of any sort. But the downside is that it was very, 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 very slow. It was our friends in Europe mostly use tape cassettes on their computers. And you'll hear talk about them like spending 5 minutes to load a level of a game, and then 20 seconds later, they lose, and they have to spend another 5 minutes to load that game. And that was just part of the experience. I think there's a little bit of a Stockholm syndrome there.
I was going to say, I think they're like 110 baud, which is about 110 bits per second or something, which is really slow. So,
I did have a Coleco Atom with a disc, a cassette drive.
Yeah.
And so I know the pain of our British friends.
I had a TRS-80 color computer, too. I think I vaguely remember my dad was loading a program on his Tandy 1000, and I was just so fascinated by the noises it made and that the lever was closed. I think it was like 3 years old that I undid the floppy drive lever as it was going, and it ruined whatever thing he was copying. So he was like, I'm going to get you your own computer. Don't touch mine again. So it was TRS-80, and it had a cartridge slot on the side, but it also had a tape adapter. And the tape adapter also doubled as a very terrible music player. If you wanted to play your cassettes through it, like one very awful speaker. But yeah, I have memories of just sitting there, like click.
Yeah, wait 30 minutes. Yeah, that was the pain of it. We had a couple games on cassette for the Atari 800, and they happened to be pretty terrible games. So if it's been a few years since I played them, I'd load them up, and it takes like an hour to load it. And then you play it for 10 minutes, like, this is terrible, and you just wasted an hour.
Did it really take an hour, or is that just like childhood memory?
God, it felt like an hour. It was probably literally 15 minutes or more.
But I will say that in the defense of tape cassettes, they were very cheap. And also, they had really high storage capacity. Like, you could store a lot on there. I mentioned the Coleco Atom earlier. ColecoVision's kind of their killer app when the system launched was Donkey Kong on cartridge. But like pretty much every other cartridge version of Donkey Kong, it was not the complete game. It was missing levels. But the Coleco Atom version, which came on a cassette, did have all the stages in the proper order and everything, so you could get the real Donkey Kong experience, which is something you can't even get on Nintendo's own systems until that one really limited hack that they sent out that not everyone has been able to play of Donkey Kong. So you take the good with the bad, mostly bad, but there was a little good to it. In this case, this device is called Deco. It's the Data East cassette something operation. I can't remember exactly, but basically, it was an arcade system designed in 1979, 1980, and the arcade system had this big frame inside of it, and at the top of it, there was a little cassette port, and they would distribute their games on tape cassettes, and so arcade operators could very easily swap out the cassette and have basically a new game. They'd put new labels, new stickers on the side of the cabinet, and games like Lock and Chase and a few other kind of famous games came from the Deco system. And it was a very inexpensive alternative to buying an entirely new arcade machine, because at the time you didn't have the JAMA system that is kind of the standard of arcades starting in like 1987 or so. So it was a good improvement for arcade owners. And unlike computer tape cassettes, they didn't have to wait for the game to load every time they played. The game would load entirely into memory at the start of the day or whenever you turned on the machine. And then once it loaded, it was in the RAM, and so it just worked like a normal video game cabinet. You guys ever play any Deco games?
Nope.
No. Well,
there you go. I don't know that I've ever actually used a Deco machine myself. I can't imagine that they held up very well over time, but they were a good innovation back in the early 80s. Yeah, there's the Coleco Atom. You can see someone putting a diskette into the diskette tray. That's while there is a cartridge of Rock and Rope next to it.
Yeah, cassette. It had a high-speed cassette drive that could load a lot faster than other machines.
It still took a while, though.
But they had a bug where if you left the cassette in, when you turned it on, it would wipe the tape. So
yeah,
they put a sticker on it.
I think the computer sent out an electromagnetic pulse. You get with a nuclear bomb every time it turned on. So you know how they say if there's a nuke, then airplanes will crash because their computers will die. Well, this basically was a tiny nuke in your living room, and the airplane was your copy of Donkey Kong.
So the next time an airplane crashes, it's because somebody turned on a Coleco Atom.
Yes, don't ever turn one of these on. This is how Lost started, thank you. Every 108 minutes, you have to turn off the machine.
Yeah.
There's another one. Nintendo had one of these too, the Famicom Data Recorder. And if you ever played the game Excitebike and were wondering, hey, how come it's saying load or save? I can't do that. Well, that's because it was designed to go with this cassette player that was only available in Japan, along with an entire keyboard and a basic cartridge with extra RAM in it that turned your Famicom into it was the family computer. Well, this actually made it literal. And there were a few games, including Excitebike, and I think Mach Rider and Wrecking Crew, that worked for it. And they didn't bother to take out that code in the U.S. versions because they weren't sure if they were going to release the cassette player here. So don't try to load data into Excitebike because it'll just cause your NES to hang.
I wonder if it would work if you wired it up to the port on the bottom.
Expansion port,
the code might support it.
I tried that, but I don't think I had the full setup, so it just hung.
You really tried that?
I did really try
that. On an NES?
Wow. On an NES.
Cool. Yeah.
And
I actually,
same thing.
You sold me your one of those things, so
I did.
I have it.
I thought it was really, really neat, and then I got it and it was I
can't do anything.
Don't actually need this.
Yeah.
This is not useful to me. So as much as I love the maroon cassette player, it's now at Binge's home.
Yep.
These are kind of like cartridges, but they're smaller. You can hold them in your hand, as Sega's beautiful hand model did many times over.
Yeah.
I just want to admire this packaging for a minute. It's so good. It's so good.
It's so Cartesian.
Just
grid-based.
It just it folds into itself. It's just staring into the future. Wow.
A few of my friends have full, complete sets of games for different consoles. And I always joke, where's your SMS set? I want to see the beautiful artwork on your wall. This is just that.
Yeah, some dude's hand.
Just hands and
I'm not
stripes.
Joking. The one thing I bought this year at PAX was Ghost House. Because they had it complete in cartridge, in box. And I was I got to own this guy's hand. It's so good.
Yeah.
But Sega wasn't the only company that did that. I think Hudson and NEC had much greater success with the TurboGrafx-16 PC Engine, which had these devices called Hue cards, or Huck cards, or Who cards, whatever. They were Hudson cards, and they didn't have as much data capacity as a big cartridge, but they had some pretty good games on them, like R-Type and some other stuff. Name some other games. What's that? Keith Courage. No, some good games, I said.
Yeah.
Anyway, the cards were less expensive, and they had less capacity, and they were easier to lose, but I don't know, there's just something appealing about them. And the TurboGrafx, I don't know if you've ever seen the Japanese version, the PC Engine, it's about the size of three CD cases stacked up. It's so tiny. So it makes sense that this cartridge would plug into it. In the American version, they said, Americans don't like small things, so let's just add a bunch of empty space to it. And now the cards look kind of silly, but what can you do?
Plus, you can put one of these in your wallet and pull it out to confuse bartenders when they card you.
Just put it on my card. Yeah. My name is Bonk.
The name's Courage. Keith Courage.
You can be Keith Courage. I'll be Bonk.
You'll be Bonk. Okay. I'm fine with that.
People think I'm really naughty in England.
Yeah.
Optical media. We're finally there. So, Benj made an interesting comment before this panel. You said that, or was it you, Bob? Said, oh, I think it was Bob. Never mind, Benj, I'm giving you credit you don't deserve. Yeah. Terrible.
I don't deserve it.
Sorry, anything. Bob, I wasn't trying to diminish you.
It's okay.
But you said CDs are interesting because they're the first medium that was a step backward.
In processing power. So, of course, CDs were a cheap way to get a lot more storage into one spot. And at the time, of course, they were also advertised as how durable they were, which is kind of hilarious in hindsight. But, yeah, if you take games that are released on the N64 and the PlayStation, everybody knows what PlayStation 1 loading time is like. So, you know, you don't get the CD-quality music because it would cost too much to put all those extra chips in the cartridge. But, yeah, it's, in my opinion, that was the first time that it was a step down in performance, at least. But, you know, you get a lot more for your buck, I guess. Yeah,
so you are Team N64 versus Team PlayStation.
I know, I'm about to get beat up after this, but I actually don't like the N64.
Oh, okay.
I don't
know. So you think it has a better storage capacity or storage medium, but you don't
like it? I'm a fan of the cartridges over CDs where possible. So,
what would you think if the PlayStation had used cartridges?
I think for the time, I don't think it would have worked as well because you wouldn't have been able to get the CD quality audio and those amazing full motion video games that aged so well. But at the time, I think it would have probably hurt Sony over other places. And also at the time, too, anybody that remembers reading the magazines back then, it was always, you know, the new and exciting CD technology. The Sega CD is going to have something that you've never seen before. The Nintendo CD is going to be better than the Sega CD. And it was such a thing that was important to everybody back then because it seemed so futuristic.
It was futuristic. I mean, it was crazy because I did a piece about CD technology. I mean, you're talking about 650 megabytes on a disc in 1985 1982 is when they first came out, but like when the first CD-ROM drive came out in 85, I mean, most floppy drives held 128K or something, you know, it's like a technology from the future. You couldn't help but feel like it was
It's on here. Okay, so the Sega cards don't do it, but the Master System games would always say, like, the 1 mega cartridge, mm-hmm. and that meant megabit. So that was 1/8 of 1 megabyte, whereas a CD-ROM held 650 megabytes.
Yeah.
So you can see there's a huge disparity in terms of capabilities, in terms of storage capacity, and as a result, that opened up all kinds of new horizons for game design. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, you know, as Bob mentioned, people were able to create bigger games. I mean, we're about to get a Final Fantasy VII remake, but the original Final Fantasy VII, like, its entire marketing campaign in America revolved around the fact that it was on CD-ROM, and it couldn't have been on CD-ROM if it had been a Nintendo 64 game. They were like, hey, go get the guys at Nintendo blindfold, because we're going to shoot them. Blindfold a cigarette, that's right. Like, they deserve to die for using cartridges. That's kind of mean-spirited, but also that was just like the sort of hype that surrounded CD-ROM, because you had games that just could be bigger, more beautiful, more impressive than was possible on cartridges. And yes, you had loading times, but, you know, developers found ways to mitigate that in a lot of ways. Some of the best games had very little loading time back in the PlayStation and, you know, GameCube, Dreamcast era. Like, people got pretty good at kind of working around those limitations. Of course, you didn't get the add-ons to CD-ROMs you could have to cartridges, so no real-time clock inside of your CD-ROM. That just wasn't physically possible, but there were, let's see, there we go, yeah, there we go. People did come up with some kludges and figured out ways to expand the capabilities of the consoles with memory cards. Sony had the Pocket Station, and Dreamcast had the VMU, which were like tiny computers that were also memory cards. They could play games, and they could kind of expand the features of the games that they shipped with.
And you only have to change the battery once a week.
Yeah. You'd know because it would beep very loudly at you.
Yeah, it'd beep at you. I hate that.
I know that the Dreamcast has a very relaxing startup sound, but the real sound of the Dreamcast startup is beep, beep. So we were kind of running low on time, but I did want to talk about a few other little forms of memory. This is it's a cartridge, but it's not a typical, you know, like solid-state ROM cartridge. This is a flash cartridge for Neo Geo Pocket Color. And this is pretty much what we use now. This was, to my knowledge, the first mass-produced system, mass-market system, to use flash-based technology as its primary storage medium.
Yeah.
And flash is great because it's durable, it's not magnetic, you can't erase it easily, but you can rewrite it.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting choice. I still don't know why they did that, other than probably easy to manufacture. They can make blank cartridges and just program them, flash them, I guess, and put a label on them and send them out.
Yeah, and when Aruz, the gambling company, bought SNK, they were able to repurpose Neo Geo Pocket systems to turn them into pachinko machines and rewrite all those Neo Geo Pocket color games to be pachinko games. So it worked out great for everyone. There's also the disk zip drive, sorry. Benj, I know you're a big fan of the zip drive.
Yeah, that's not a zip drive. That's a 64DD drive.
Yeah, that's based on zip technology.
Really?
It was.
I don't know. Is that true, anybody? I don't think so.
It was based on zip technology, yes.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
Dreamcast was also going to have a zip-based storage add-on technology, but didn't happen.
I know that. Yeah, they had a real zip drive for that. It's crazy.
This was based on zip technology, I swear to God.
Okay.
Promise.
No, I'm just saying. I mean,
it wasn't a floppy drive.
There was a prototype Dreamcast zip drive that never came out. That's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Yes.
It was actually branded as zip.
Whereas 64DD just used that technology. But zip drive was like a high-capacity diskette.
Yeah.
And in addition to being vulnerable to magnetism, it was also vulnerable to itself and would just eventually die. And I was saving a lot of college art projects on these zip drives, and I always had to keep two of them on hand because one of them would start clicking at me, and that meant you could never use it again.
Yeah.
Great tech. Ooh. There's GD-ROM, which is a CD-ROM, but bigger, and DVD-ROM, which is like GD-ROM, but bigger. Uh-huh. And then there's cloud-based storage. So this is kind of where our story ends, because there's not really a whole lot of new innovation happening in terms of game storage, game technology, games media. We've kind of, I think, hit sort of a plateau where we're going to see maybe something in the future, but for now, I think everything works pretty well the way it should. Although, Benj, I don't think you're a big fan of cloud-based storage. Based on the comments you made on our notes, they were all very...
I did?
Yeah, I think you did.
I don't know.
You made some comments that seemed very critical. Were you just in a bad mood?
I've always criticized cloud stuff just because you're putting control of your data in someone else's hands, and I'd rather... I mean, the whole idea of the personal computer wasn't empowering the individual to have their own computer that do what they want without oversight or supervision or anything. And so it's sort of the opposite trend is going on right now. So that's my beef with cloud computing. But it's cool that you can download games now to hard drives. I think that's awesome. I'd rather do that than have shuffle a bunch of cartridges or CDs all the time.
Bob, any final thoughts?
You know, I'm both leery of and a giant fan of cloud-based storage. Like, all my Google Docs and stuff are saved there, which of course I back up to a hard drive every time I remember because I don't trust anybody else with my data, and that's the other side of it, is you're trusting other people with your data. I remember a few friends said, I don't even need my backup drivers anymore. I'm going to pay for Amazon's cloud storage. That'll be available forever. And what, they kill that project after a year or something like that? So, yeah, your data is your own, so make sure to... Now, I have 20 years of IT, two backups of everything, or else, you know, two is one and one is none. So, cloud storage.
Yeah, I mean, in addition to cloud storage, there have been attempts at cloud-based distributed gaming. I put the cloud joke up here, one, because haha, but also because Square Enix really made an effort to create their own, cloud-based game service, which they very foolishly called Shinra. That's just, like, don't name it after the villain. That's just feeding into everyone's paranoia. But that it didn't work out for them. I don't think anyone's really figured it out. I mean, Google just launched Stadia a few months ago.
Yeah, Stadia.
What's that?
Stadia.
Stadia?
Stadia, yeah.
That's what I said, yeah.
Yeah. I'm just repeating you. Okay. I'm your parrot, man.
But even Google, like this giant megalithic company that owns everything in the world now, like even they haven't figured it out. So there's still some kinks in the system to be worked out. But anyway, guys, just as we wrap, what is your favorite form of video games media storage, and why is it cartridges?
Besides cartridges?
It is, yes.
Floppy disk.
Why is it cartridges?
Why is it cartridges? Okay, because cartridges are great. They're durable, instant, loading.
But really, if you could just make a game and put it on any storage media, it doesn't matter the technology running the system, what would it be?
I don't know. CDs are pretty good because you can fit a lot of data on them. If you had a fast enough drive to load it up real quick, like a 53X or whatever, that'd be good.
What do you love so much about CDs?
A lot of capacity.
Versus a DVD-ROM or a Blu-ray ROM?
Yeah, you can burn them real quick.
Oh, okay. There you go.
I'm not talking about like Glass Master in the 80s or something, where you have to pay $100,000 to make a master.
For me, it's definitely cartridges because of speed and durability. I think you see, you know, these consoles that are in the 70s are still working as long as you don't like, you know, as long as nobody spilled soda on them or tried to clean them with metal polish or anything like that. And, you know, they're still going to work and they're probably going to outlast, or they at least have the potential to outlast all other media for the short term, at least, meaning like 50 years plus because of how they're built. I'm interested to see what will last the longest, though, because CDs are about 100 years, they think, for, you know, laser discs are already starting to rot out. So I'm kind of curious what's going to be the longest, but...
I would say, I think ROM chips, because they're etched in silicon, like if you don't consider all the pins and other components in the cartridge, I mean, the piece of silicon inside the ROM chip is going to last eons, you know, I think.
Yeah, I don't know if the... speaker on Robopon is still working, but but you know, like Air Sea Attack for Atari 2600, that still works.
Yeah.
All right, everyone. I think that's all we have. So we're going to let you go, and you can go to other panels or go to bed if you're old like us. It's up to you. But thanks for coming out and taking time out of your Saturday evening.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
You could have been playing Steel Battalion, but instead you came here, and we really appreciate it. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, thanks. Thank
you. See you next time.
Welcome to Casual Magic, the show where we explore the fun side of Magic the Gathering. I'm your host, Shivam Putt, and each week we delve into everything from casual format to explorations of creatures and card types to interviews with designers of the game. At Casual Magic, we believe that it just isn't magic without the gathering. Come along and play!
Hunter, Hunter, Yu Yu Hakusho, Literary Analysis, Comparative Localization, JoJo References. The works of Yoshihiro Togashi hold a specific kind of magic, and the people who seek to examine their roots and spiritual descendants are known as the Spirit Hunters, available on the Greenlit Podcast Network.
Hello, my name is Jonathan Dunn, and I'm inviting you to listen to Our 3 Cents, a weekly podcast where myself and two of my very best gaming chums are counting down our top 100 favourite video games of all time. For all the episodes and information, check out our website, www.our3cents.co.uk.
Video Death Loop is a podcast where we watch a short video clip on loop until we just can't take it anymore. Along the way, we'll try our best to make each other laugh and to hold out longer than the other guy. You can jump in on any episode, no need to worry about continuity. Check out Video Death Loop on the Greenlit Podcast Network with new episodes every Friday.